Well, good morning, everyone. If everyone would like to take their seats, I think we are just about ready to start. A few bleary eyes out there this morning, late night last night. All raring to go for another hour. Okay, so this morning, we're going to go back to Deuteronomy. We were working on Deuteronomy a while back, and we left that to take a break and do some John. But we'd sort of reached the point in John where it was getting up to Easter, so we thought we'd better leave that for now and just go back and do a little bit more of Deuteronomy. So this morning we're going to be doing Deuteronomy chapter 24. It's going to be a little more of a study rather than a sermon, I guess, but let's see how we go. So before we start, before we do our reading, let's make a start with some songs. I'll just take my place in the band.
Yes, if you'd all like to stand up, like you, we'll all start our singing. First one is How Great Is Our God. Changing for me. The next song that we have is How Deep the Father's Love for Us.
Thank you.
with another nice oldie, Power of Your Love.
Well, good job, band, carrying the pianist there. Okay. So, I think we probably should just do a bit of a recap on our introduction to Deuteronomy. We did this quite a few times when we first started, but things we haven't visited it for a while, might be a good idea to just have a bit of a look at it. So, of course, we know it was written by Moses around the time of his death. So Moses has just taken leadership of Israel and led them through the wilderness. And there's a lot of stuff in Deuteronomy, a lot of instruction, a lot of rules about how the nation was to be run. And a lot of good information as well. A lot of good, interesting stories in there as well. You can really divide the book up into three sections. The past, where it talks about the retelling of the story of the wilderness journey and the trouble that Israel caused to God. And it goes into the laws, the ceremonial laws, the civil laws, and the personal laws, and that's really the section that we're looking at the moment. And then through to chapter 27 to 31, talking about the covenant between God and his people, and Moses' final words and hand over to Joshua. So before we start our reading, I think I'll just flick back to the Lord's Prayer and ask you to bow your heads while I read the Lord's Prayer according to Luke chapter 11. Our Father, which art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, as in heaven, so in earth. Give us day by day our daily bread, and forgive us our sins. For we also forgive everyone that is indebted to us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. So, up to chapter 24. And it's sort of a mixed bag of instructions here. It talks about marriage, it talks about newlyweds, it talks about taking pledges, human trafficking, leprosy, hired servants, individuals' responsibilities. It really jumps around quite a lot. I think what I might do is just read it through first. We'll have a song and then I'll come back and talk about individual sections because there's a few comments that can be made. So starting at verse 1, when a man hath taken a wife and married her, and it come to pass that she find no favour in his eyes, because he hath found some uncleanness in her, then let him write her a bill of divorcement, and give it in her hand, and send her out of his house. And when she is departed out of his house, she may go and be another man's wife. And if the latter husband hate her, and write her a bill of divorcement, and giveth it in her hand, and sendeth her out of his house, or if the latter husband die, which took her to be his wife, her former husband, which sent her away, may not take her again to be his wife, after that she is defiled. For that is abomination before the Lord, and thou shalt not cause the land to sin, which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance. Now this seems like a really strange instruction, and it's something that was obviously debated over the years, and it's something that I think a lot of people really have a lot of differing opinions about today of how it should be interpreted. But it was obviously a point of contention because it was something that the Pharisees challenged Jesus on, trying to tempt him and trying to get him to make a decision which would make him make a mistake. And I'd like to read that section in Matthew where that happened, Matthew chapter 19. The Pharisees also came unto him, tempting him and saying unto him, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? And he answered and said unto them, have you not read that he which made them at the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this cause shall a man leave father and mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they twain shall be one flesh. Wherefore, they are no more twain, but one flesh. What therefore God hath joined together, let not man put asunder. So that seems to be really at odds with this instruction that was given by Moses. So they were trying to take him to task on this. They say unto him, why did Moses then command to give a writing of divorcement and to put her away? He said unto them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, suffered you to put away your wives. But from the beginning it was not so. And I say unto you, whosoever shall put away his wife except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery. And whoso marrieth her which is put away doth commit adultery. So once again, Jesus has just turned it right around and thrown it back to them with the original instruction that was given to man, that if a man and a wife and a woman join together, they become one flesh. And that was the intention, that they would stay that way. Now, I might come back and talk about that a bit again later, so we can keep going through the chapter. But there's a few questions in there. What does it mean, because he hath found some uncleanness in her, after that she is defiled? It's sort of a really confusing instruction that's worth just looking to at in a little bit more depth to see if we can get a bit of understanding about it. So we'll come back to that. So here's a good instruction. When a man hath taken a new wife, he shall not go out to war, neither shall he be charged with any business, but he shall be free at home 1 year, and shall cheer up his wife which he hath taken. Now, I've been married nearly 40 years, is it? Nearly 50 years. I haven't really worked out how to cheer up my wife yet. So maybe it was because I didn't have a year off when we first got married. But it's an interesting instruction. They weren't to go out to war. If somebody had done something, even if they planted a new vineyard or built a new house or married a new wife, then they weren't to be uprooted and sent to war and disturbed. They're given a time to settle down. Okay, the next one, taking pledges. Now, pledges, we don't really use that terminology much these days, but it's a very common thing. For there aren't many people these days that can buy property or a lot of things without actually borrowing money. And if you borrow money, then whoever lends it to you wants a pledge. In the case of purchasing a house, it's called a mortgage. They have a right that if you don't pay them back, they can take the house back off you. So it can involve a promise to do something or not to do something, or a legal arrangement where an asset can be held as collateral or to secure a debt. So there were rules about this. No man shall take the nether or the upper millstone to pledge, for he taketh a man's life to pledge. Now this is an interesting one. I've got a picture there on the left there of a millstone. I guess they came in various forms, but of course this is how the grain was crushed so that it could be used for flour. And you can see that there's a stone as the base, and then there's another round stone as the, well, it calls it here the upper millstone or the nether millstone. It says you're not allowed to take that as a pledge. Well, doesn't really mean a lot to us today, but the meaning behind it, of course, does mean a lot. If you're taking a pledge of someone, you don't take what they use to earn their living with or to feed themselves with. So these instructions, even though they might not directly apply to us, the principle is there. The principle is still the same. If you're taking a pledge, then it can't be in such a way that people can't work, can't live to actually pay you back. Now, this is an interesting one, this next one, human trafficking. If a man be found stealing any of his brethren of the children of Israel and make merchandise of him or selleth him, then that thief shall die, and thou shalt put evil away from among you. Well, that's certainly something in our society. We can see that our society is really based on these instructions that God gave to Israel. We could say that our society is a Judeo-Christian society. And these basic instructions that were given are just so important as a basis. Obviously, human trafficking is very much despised these days. There were times when slave trade was actually a way of life, and people made a business of it, and was just a part of the things that happened. But fortunately, due to the work of some very diligent, very strong men that followed their beliefs, that was outlawed, and it certainly looked down on these days that selling people, it just is not on. Okay, now it moves on to leprosy. As I say, it jumps all over the place. Take heed in the plague of leprosy, that thou observe diligently, and do according to all that the priests, the Levites, shall teach you, as I commanded them, so ye shall observe to do. And we won't go into those instructions, but they're in Leviticus chapter 13. There were strict instructions that they had to follow. If they suspected that somebody had a disease, then the priest would inspect it, and they had ways to determine whether that was what sort of disease it was, and if it was a contagious type of disease, well, then they were shut out of the camp. As it says in the next verse, remember what the Lord thy God did unto Miriam by the way, after that ye were come forth out of Egypt. So let's just read what happened to Miriam. Now, I'm sure most people would know the story. Moses was the leader, but originally when God put him in the position, he wasn't confident that he could do it. And God said, well, your brother Aaron, he's a good talker. He can do the speaking. I'll speak to you, you speak to Aaron. And his sister Miriam, obviously, very close-knit family. So Aaron and Miriam were really right up the top there in the government of the Israelites as they were travelling through the wilderness. Now, prior to Moses being told by God to go and lead the people out of Egypt, he had spent, I think it was something like 40 years with the Midianites. He'd run away from Egypt, and he'd married a Midianite woman, and of course that was not looked on as something that the Israelites should have done. That they saw that as the wrong thing, and Miriam and Aaron were criticizing Moses about that, and they said to him, well, look, we're leading just as much as you. Why should you be in charge? Why shouldn't it be us? So it was a real bid for the takeover of the running of the nation. Well, I can't say the nation at that stage, but the Israelite people. And so they confronted Moses and condemned him for this act, and said they wanted to take over. Well, then we read what happened. So God came down on the tabernacle in a cloud, and when the cloud departed from the tabernacle, Miriam became leprous, white as snow. And Aaron looked upon Miriam and said, and behold, she was leprous. And Aaron said unto Moses, alas, my Lord, I beseech thee, lay not this sin upon us, wherein we have done foolishly and wherein we have sinned. Let her not be as one dead, of whom the flesh is half consumed, when he cometh out of his mother's womb. Moses cried unto the Lord, saying, heal her now, O God, I beseech thee. And the Lord said unto Moses, if her father had but spit in her face, should she not be ashamed 7 days? Let her be shut out from the camp 7 days, and after that, let her be received in again. And Miriam was shut out from the camp 7 days, and the people journeyed not until Miriam was brought in again. And that was one of the instructions. Of course, Moses prayed to God and Miriam was healed, but there was a process that they had to follow. They were to be shut out of the camp for 7 days and then checked again by the priest to make sure that they were clean, make sure that the disease had gone. And so that was the process. That's what happened to Miriam, by the way. Even though she'd had a direct healing from God in that manner, she had to be shut from the rest of the people until she was. It was proven that she was healed. Now, there's an interesting story in the Gospels about a similar sort of case. Luke chapter 5, where Jesus heals a leper. And I'd like to read that, verse 12. Came to pass when he was in a certain city, behold, a man full of leprosy, who, seeing Jesus, fell on his face and besought him, saying, Lord, if thou wilt, thou canst make me clean. And he put forth his hand and touched him, saying, I will, be thou clean. And immediately the leprosy departed from him. And he charged him to tell no man, but go and show thyself to the priest and offer thy cleansing according as Moses commanded, for a testimony unto them. So even though this man had received that immediate cleansing from Jesus, Jesus said, follow the instructions that were given to Moses. There were a set of instructions that were given. So presumably this man would have had to make the offerings that were described in Leviticus 13. He would have gone to the priest. He probably would have been shut out for 7 days and then come back. And then it would have been proven that he was healed, that he was clean. So these instructions, I think it's important that we understand the principle behind it. There are instructions given that we should be following, not necessarily relating to leprosy in these days, but in general, the instructions that God gave to Moses are really the basis of our society. Now, a couple more. Recovering a pledge. When thou dost lend thy brother anything, thou shalt not go into his house to fetch his pledge. Thou shalt stand abroad, and the man to whom thou dost lend shall bring out the pledge unto thee. And if the man be poor, thou shalt not sleep with his pledge. In any case, thou shalt deliver him the pledge again when the sun goeth down, that he may sleep in his own raiment. And bless thee, it shall be righteousness unto thee before the Lord thy God. So I think this is a really interesting one as far as being respectful to people. If you've loaned someone money, it doesn't mean you have the right to go and invade that person's privacy. They have a right to their own privacy, to their own place, and there's only so far you can go. What we're talking about here is a time when people, poor people, probably had nothing to their name other than the clothes that they were wearing. So if they had to give a pledge to somebody to guarantee that they were going to repay a debt to them, they would probably have to give them their coat. So this is really a merciful instruction to say, well, if the bloke's only got a coat to sleep in, then you've got to give it back to him that night so he can sleep. It's only reasonable. Even if it is a pledge, you don't have the right to take that from him. And I think we can extend that to our situation today, that if we do lend money to people, well, we're often told that we should even be grateful if it comes back, and if it doesn't come back, well, we shouldn't have lent it to them in the first place. So the pledge really is just a token of an assurance, but we're not going to take it to the extent that we're going to really destroy that person or take away their last possession. Now, the next one I think is very good. It applies. It's about hired servants. Thou shalt not oppress an hired servant that is poor and needy, whether he be of thy brethren or of thy strangers that are in thy land within thy gates. At his day thou shalt give him his hire, neither shall the sun go down upon it. For he is poor and setteth his heart upon it, lest he cry against thee unto the Lord, and it be sin unto thee. So I guess this is to the employers. If you're employing people on wages, pay them on the day. Make sure you pay them what they're worth. But I think it also applies if we have a bill that we have to pay someone. If we have the money to pay it, we should pay it straight away. If you've got the money by you, pay it. Don't let the sun go down before you pay your just debts. There's a couple more. I think this might be the last couple. And this one's about taking responsibility for your own actions. Verse 16, the fathers shall not be put to death for the children, neither shall the children be put to death for the fathers. Every man shall be put to death for his own sin. Now, this is a bit of a confusing one because if we go back to Deuteronomy, read a little portion here from chapter 5, starting at verse 8. Thou shalt not make thee any graven image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in earth beneath, or that is in the waters beneath the earth. Thou shalt not bow down thyself unto them, nor serve them, for I, the Lord thy God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children unto the third and fourth generation of them that hate me, and showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. So I guess this is why this statement has been made originally, when that instruction about not bowing down to graven images was given. God is saying that if a person hates God, then that blame he will carry through to the third and fourth generation. But Moses is stating clearly that everyone takes responsibility for their own actions. It's not a matter of children being put to death for their parents' actions, or vice versa. The person that does the error pays for their own actions. And it's interesting to note back in Deuteronomy there that God is only going to do that for people that hate him. And it's really the other way around, showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. So you could take that as thousands of generations. A lot of people take it that way. But God will be merciful if we love him and we keep his commandments. And there's another verse there from Ezekiel that sort of backs up what Moses is saying. There's a proverb concerning the land of Israel saying, the fathers have eaten the sour grapes and the children's teeth are set on edge. As I live, saith the Lord God, ye shall not have occasion any more to use this proverb in Israel. Behold, all souls are mine, the soul of the father, the soul of the son is mine, the soul that sinneth, it shall die. Again, we take responsibility for our own actions. We're not responsible. The father is not responsible for the children, and the children are not responsible for the father. It goes on in this tone now, talking about justice and mercy. Verse 17. Thou shalt not pervert the judgment of the stranger nor of the fatherless, nor take a widow's raiment to pledge. But thou shalt remember that thou wast a bondman in Egypt, and the Lord thy God redeemed thee thence. Therefore I command thee to do this thing. So, sort of going back to that situation of the pledge again, being merciful, having respect of people, not overdoing it in taking pledges, fair judgment, whether the person is a stranger or they're an orphan, particularly if they're a stranger or an orphan or a widow. Okay, let's move on to the last one here. When thou cuttest down thine harvest in thy field and hast forgot a sheaf in the field, thou shalt not go again to fetch it. It shall be for the stranger, for the fatherless, and for the widow, that the Lord thy God may bless thee in all the work of thine hands. When thou beatest thine olive tree, thou shalt not go over the boughs again. It shall be for the stranger, for the fatherless, and the widow. When thou gatherest the grapes of thy vineyard, thou shalt not glean it afterward. It shall be for the stranger, for the fatherless, and for the widow. And thou shalt remember that thou wast a bondman in the land of Egypt. Therefore I command thee to do this thing. So again, a specific instruction given at the time to take care for the poor. They wouldn't have had any social security. If a woman was a widow, they would have no one to provide for them. The children would have, the orphan children would have no one to provide for them. And this is a really great provision that was put in place, that they were an agricultural society, they would have been living off the land, and they were to leave some of that produce of the land so that the poor people could feed themselves. And that was their right, to go and feed themselves. And I guess in our society today, we have the same sort of thing enshrined in our society, where poor people, people that are in trouble, that have that can't provide for themselves, can apply for this social security. It's the same sort of thing, and we're taxed, of course. That's been taken out of our hands. It's under the control of the government to tax us and to provide for the poor. But of course, it doesn't stop us also helping the poor if we see an occasion to do that as well. And I think it's worth remembering that verse from Proverbs 19:17, where it says, "He that hath pity upon the poor lendeth unto the Lord, and that which he hath given will he pay him again." So if we do give to people that are in need, we don't necessarily expect anything back, but God is saying that we will be repaid for it. So you don't need to worry about that. Don't worry about giving things to the poor, giving things to people that are in need, because God considers that as a loan to him, and he will repay us. Okay, I think we should have a hymn now. Linda's going to help us out there with the organ. Hymn number 115. Okay, we'll do hymn 79. Visionary hymn. The light of life is flowing the darkness to dispel, and is in truth revealing the mysteries of the fall. All Israel it is bringing from every distant shore. No more will they be mourning their blindness to deplore. Thank you. Thank you, Linda. Now, I said, when we started, I said I want to talk a little bit more about this section on the marriage and divorce. We're running a bit out of time, but so I'll try and be quicker on that. So it's a bit of an interesting one because Jesus is saying the original intention was that man and wife should be joined together and not separated. And this loophole came into the system there. And it's interesting that how did that happen? Why did that happen? Moses obviously had a problem. He was a man that was on the spot. He had to make the whole thing work. He had to make decisions. And maybe sometimes he didn't make decisions in consultation with God. Maybe not all of the things that he said. Well, we know that he really got into trouble for striking the rock twice and not carrying out God's instructions. And for the occasions when he didn't carry out God's instructions, he was told that he wouldn't be going into the promised land. So this one here that he has allowed divorce is something that Jesus is would seem to be taking a stricter line on, or is it that we just don't understand the situation that Moses was trying to cover? Jesus does give the exception there, except it be for fornication. He gives that as the only reason, valid reason for divorce. So, looking just a bit closer at the text there, the reason that a man can use for this bill of divorcement is that he's found some uncleanness in her. Well, what does that mean? Does she have dirty fingernails? Or it's hard to know what that meant. There were ritual cleansings that people had to go through with the women in their time of separation. They might have had issue of their blood, and perhaps the woman wasn't following those rules correctly, and the man was in opposition to that. That may have been some reason for it. It might have been fornication, which is the thing that Jesus mentions specifically. Maybe he finds out that she was actually a fornicator. Although there are separate laws that they had to cover that situation, and they weren't pretty very nice either, the result of those ones. Of course, fornication can also having connection in the time when the people were told not to have connection, and it could have been something to do with that. So we don't really know exactly what it was, what that uncleanness was. The other thing that's a little bit confusing to understand here is, okay, so this woman's been divorced, married another man, and then that's broken down either because of a death or because he's kicked her out again. But she can't go back to the original husband after that. She is defiled. So we're not really told what that means either, after she's defiled. Maybe it's defiled because she's been with another man and that is taken as a defilement. That sort of fits in with what Jesus is saying in his conditions of when this would apply. He says, whosoever shall put away his wife except it be for fornication, and shall marry another, committeth adultery, and whoso marrieth her which is put away doth commit adultery. So it's a bit of a tricky one. It's something that in our society is certainly not taken to this extent. And it's something that if we choose to follow the laws, then we would need to really consider whether this is for us and how we should be handling it. So if I can just go now to a bit of a summary of what we've been looking at in this chapter. And really, in summary, these laws, all of these laws we've been looking at are about treating people in the right way, treating people righteously. It talks about wives, it talks about newlyweds, humans, slaves and brethren, sick people, debtors, hired labour, parents and children, strangers, widows and fatherless, and poor people. So it seems like a bit of a mixed bag in this chapter, all of these, this collection of instructions that's been given. But if we look at it as a whole, we can see that it's to try and make sure that people are treated fairly and righteously. Jesus was again confronted by the Pharisees, and at the end of the tempting by them of him, he made this statement where one of the Pharisees said, "Master, what is the great commandment in the law?" Jesus said unto him, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with thy soul and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. And the second is like unto it. Thou shalt love thy neighbour as thyself. On these two commandments hang all the law and prophets." And so these instructions that we've been reading about in this chapter today are really related to that second commandment. If we love our neighbours, we must treat them righteously. And Micah, in the book of Micah, sums it up pretty well. Micah 6:8. "He hath showed thee, O man, what is good, and what doth the Lord require of thee, but to do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God." And the attitude that is instructed here with all of these rules that we've read about today reflect those three principles: to be just to people, to be merciful to people, and to be humble, to walk humbly with thy God. So I think that's what I got out of that chapter. Quite apart from the direct instructions, that should be our attitude when we're dealing with people in whatever we do. So with that, I think we'll have another hymn. And this time, we will have hymn number 115. Thanks, Linda. Changing scenes of life, in trouble and in joy, the praise of Israel's God will still the faithful heart employ. Thank you. Just like to finish with that verse from Micah 6:8 again. He has showed thee, O man, what is good, and what doth the Lord require of thee, but to do justly, love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God. Thanks for coming, everyone. I'll see you all next week.